Hi everybody, today's Thursday, August 21st, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Good to be with you, Nima. Thank you for the invite.
I think many of us are interested to see, to know what's your take on the outcome of those two meetings between the United States and Russia, then between the United States and Europeans together with Zelensky. But before going there, Alex, how do you compare, looking at what has happened in Alaska and then in the United States, how do you compare the two, the nature of two meetings that have happened? And we saw pictures coming out of those meetings. Your comparison, how do you compare them?
Well, I think it was fairly obvious for everybody to see. You know, the meeting with Vladimir Putin was cordial. Both Trump and Putin walked away with very good impressions. It all seemed very encouraging and positive. And, you know, the two leaders in their meeting obviously gave the impression that they control their respective sides of their, you know, of their camps. They were in control. They were capable of making deals, of entering into negotiations and so forth. Whereas the difference with the European leaders is that everybody came there as a supplicant to Trump. Nobody came there as a sovereign making demands or ready to give concessions. They came to beg. They came to daddy, hoping to, you know, make sure that he still loves them, that he will still protect them and stay with them. And it was almost embarrassing to see them sitting around his desk as you know, like as wayward children at the principal's office. And they all looked like that. I was very surprised because, you know, on the morning of the day, I wrote in my newsletter that we will probably be able to tell more about the outcome of the meeting by the body language of Mr. Zelensky than we will by anything that they tell us in press releases and in conferences for the press. And I was surprised that it's the European leaders who looked the way I expected Zelensky to look, you know, like kind of panic, despondent, not happy. Whereas Zelensky, you know, I looked at him, he looked pretty relaxed. He looked comfortable. And I suspect because he was having a meeting with Trump one-on-one for, I think they allocated more than an hour for that meeting. And only then did they have a meeting together, Zelensky, Trump, and the Europeans. And I kind of suspect that Trump gave Vladimir Zelensky like a golden parachute, like a lifesaver deal to say, look, cooperate with this peace deal and you can extricate yourself with your head on your shoulder. You know, we'll let you walk away with this alive. And I think that this is, at this stage, this is what must be Zelensky's prime preoccupation, whether he will even save his life with this with the defeat of Ukraine. And probably he had Vladimir Putin's reassurances that they will not go after Zelensky. And I think that this is why he was as relaxed as he was. Whereas when he had that press conference with Mark Rutte, Zelensky looked like he just saw death. And on the other hand, it was the European leaders who looked like they saw death this time around. And I suspect that part of the reason has to do with those frozen Russian assets. And I have to throw that in there because you know, one of the things that Donald Trump has been doing in his shuttle diplomacy around the world is he's been getting other nations to make very heavy, very significant investments in the United States. So he got Ursula von der Leyen to commit $600 billion in EU investments in the United States. He got multi-hundred-billion-dollar deals with UAE, with Qatar, with Saudi Arabia, and so forth. And of course, I very much doubt that Trump wouldn't like a very significant investment from the Russians. And, well, you know, the Russians have about $300 to $335 billion in frozen assets in the West, and most of that money is in Europe. So it's supposedly about $70 billion in France, about $37 billion in the UK. I think something like more than 150, 180 billion in Belgium, in Euroclear. And I'm sure that Trump, and in the United States, there's only an estimated 5 to 8 billion. That's it. So I'm sure that the very obvious deal that Trump and Putin could do is to say, like, hey, you know, about those frozen assets, maybe it would be nice if you invested it in the United States. We will, you know, make sure it's preferable to EU. We will unfreeze them. We will lift some sanctions, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, if Vladimir Putin or if Russian government ordered the European countries to transfer those funds to New York, and Donald Trump said, better do it, they would have no recourse but to comply with that. And European powers have already been counting on that money as collateral that they would use to fuel another credit cycle. Emmanuel Macron has been already, or his prime minister or his finance minister, I don't remember exactly, but a few months ago, they were fantasizing about using this money as collateral with which they would then allow French banks to finance French corporations to do reconstruction and development work in Ukraine. So they would say, like, oh, well, you know, Russia destroyed Ukraine, so it's right that Russia should pay for the reconstruction, so we should use that. So they were making all these calculations, and they had all these expectations about being able, together with the United States, to simply confiscate Russian assets. And now I think that nothing's going to come off this. And instead, Trump is going to take the money back into the United States. And he's going to make a deal with the Russians. And I think the Russians themselves have every reason in the world to want to do that as well, because the direct threat to Russia is coming from Western Europe and countries like Britain, France, Germany, and Poland. And so, you know, that's exactly who you would want to deprive of that capital, because for sure, in the end, it would end up funding rearmament that would, you know, ultimately be targeting Russia. So I think that, you know, nobody mentioned this before, but I think it's an obvious blow to Europe that I think neither Putin nor Trump will be hesitating to deliver. And I think if there's one thing that's predictable about Donald Trump, is that he will want those $300 billion in the United States.
Alex, you've mentioned the meeting, and you compared the way that Zelensky was somehow behaving, and you look at the face of Europeans. And here is the picture of that meeting. I see something deeper than that, Alex. In my opinion, Zelensky, what's going on with Zelensky, he has lost everything. He doesn't care about anything else. It's just... But when it comes to Europeans, they feel, they deeply feel that the United States is leaving them. You know, they don't want to accept it. And you mentioned daddy, but they really see the United States as their daddy. If he's not at home, if he's not there, they have to fight with each other. They have to fight over things that are not that much important geopolitically, but they're so important domestically for them.
Yes, it seems to me that the Europeans have made themselves so passive and so subservient to the United States, to the, you know, Anglo-American establishment, that for decades now, not only have they followed the policies dictated by this Anglo-American elite to them, they haven't, you know, they've atrophied in every sense. In you know, they haven't charted their own course. They haven't thought through their any kind of a geostrategic path forward. A strategy of economic development, what European societies should be about, what should be their policy, what should be their aims, what should be their aspirations. They just simply adopted passively this business model of, okay, we will procure resources, energy from Russia and other sources, and natural resources from our former colonies. We will produce advanced industrial goods, and we will export them to Russia, to the United States and China. And, you know, this approach got entrenched. It seems to me that the, you know, the high level thinkers and the, let's say, the policymakers in Europe had the expectancy that the United States would always be their best friend forever, and that they would always be able to depend and lean on the United States, and that this state of affairs would last indefinitely. What they didn't take into account is that this is not necessarily favorable to U.S. interests. And for anybody who read their history, they should know that periodically, maybe once in a generation or two, there's always a reaction from out of the United States to break these bonds with the old colonialist powers of Europe, because they always treat the United States also as their, you know, colonial possession. You know, they want the United States to absorb their products, and they want the United States to keep peace in the world for them and to fight wars for them. And that has been exhausting the United States. It's been depleting the United States politically and economically and financially, and it has shredded its reputation. And we have to always remember that the United States became a country exactly as a reaction against this colonialist mindset and this model of governance. So, you know, every so often you'll have a reactions against this. And a part of American political establishment that will attempt to chart an independent course, you know. And so, you know, in the past we had, I don't know, William McKinley, you had FDR, you had John F. Kennedy, and some others, you know, depending on how you analyze it and how far they got with their attempt to change course of the United States. But Donald Trump is not something unique and radically different. He's only the latest that is trying to change course of U.S. policy away from being the errand boy for European colonial interests. Meanwhile, European leaders have become complacent in this relationship of subordination to the United States and leaning on the United States to protect their interests. And now that Trump has shown definitely that he's no longer interested, I think they're completely lost. They have no contingency plan. They have no plan B. They realize they have made no provisions for their own security. They have no independent political or economic strategies. And so they're lost. They're looking pale. They have these blank face expressions. And now they have to go back to square one and figure out what to do. I think that European Union itself, without the protective umbrella from the United States, is going to devolve to squabbling powers. European Union has no future anymore. I think the same is true for NATO. And so I think that as incompetent as those seven leaders in the White House are, they're smart enough to understand this, that you know, they have nothing to offer their voters. So, you know, they're panicked, I think.
I think one of the main achievements of these two meetings was the ceasefire case. And Donald Trump and his administration was pushing so hard with ceasefire. We want something happen in Ukraine. But it seems that the Trump administration has already removed that from their agenda.
You see, I don't see it that way exactly. I think that Trump was never seriously pushing for the ceasefire. And the reason why I believe that is because it was so obvious that this was unacceptable to Russia and that Russia didn't need to even discuss this at all. And in the discussions between Trump with Putin on the phone, you know, that started in February, and the number of meetings that Steve Witkoff had with Putin and with Lavrov, I think that Russians had plenty of opportunity to make that perfectly clear for them. And, you know, I doubt that people in the Trump administration or he himself are stupid to not understand this. So I think that the reason why they were even pushing this story about the ceasefire was simply some kind of a diversion, you know, as a psychological operation. It was a narrative for public consumption, but I think it wasn't sincere. And I think that the real things were being discussed covertly between the Russian government and the American government. All of this nonsense of General Kilogg and the ceasefire, I think this was just, let's call it, narrative appeasement to certain interest networks in the West.
Do you feel that the way that Donald Trump had an interview with Fox News in which he said that Putin is so tired and he may accept European troops, especially from the United Kingdom, Germany, and France being in Ukraine. Here is what he said before going to your response.
You got the Article 5 protections, though, for Ukraine. So they're not going to be a part of NATO, but you still got them the same protections.
So they're not going to be a part of NATO, but we've got the European nations, and they'll front load it, and they'll have some of them, France and Germany, a couple of them, UK, they want to have, boots on the ground. I don't think it's going to be a problem, to be honest with you. I think Putin is tired of it. I think they're all tired of it. But you never know. We're going to find out about President Putin in the next couple of weeks, that I can tell you. And we're going to see where it all goes.
You know, he talks about putting troops on the ground. On the other hand, we'll see what Putin would say. You know, he lets that open and to this to be discussed during the meeting. He's gonna have with Vladimir Putin. Do you feel that he's somehow? It seems to me, little by little, he's moving the case a little bit forward, and. Go ahead. And how do you
see? I think the case is definitely moving forward, Nima, and very important. I mean, let's remember where we were 7 months ago. We had Joe Biden in the White House, and we had American foreign policy driven by Jake Sullivan and Antony Blinken. This is very, very radically different. And I know that it's maybe difficult to appreciate because Trump has dragged us through 7 months of psyops and misdirection and deception and lies and nonsense. But, you know, I think this was not part of the genuine policymaking. I think that this was part of the, you know, stage managed chaos to so that nobody knows what to expect and what's going to happen in the end. And I think that this statement that you just played on the video is exactly more of that, you know, because he says Trump gives a statement which says exactly nothing. You know, Putin's tired of this. Well, you know, Putin is not going to make the error of drawing a defeat out of the jaws of victory just because he's tired and he lost patience, you know. And then Trump himself says, like, oh, yeah, it's not going to be a problem. I don't think it's going to be a problem. Well, yeah, it's not going to be a problem because the Russians are going to say no. And then he says, well, we'll find out in a couple of weeks' time, you know. And, you know, this interview, most people will not even remember it tomorrow, let alone 7 weeks from now, you know. But one thing I wanted to note, you know, there was a photograph of Zelensky with Trump along with that statement. I, you know, it strikes me because I don't think we've seen Zelensky this happy in about 3 years now.
I think he's somehow feeling that the burden he had on his shoulders is just getting away. Because most of, Alex, we have to understand what's going on with the case of Zelensky. He's a president who's sending the people of his country to the battlefield to be killed, to be murdered, in my opinion. And most of these decisions are not coming from the Ukrainian government, are coming from outside. And he may, after all, we don't know what's going on with Zelensky, after all. We don't know how does he feel. Because he's not honest the way, in my opinion, he's talking about. And who's having some sort of leverage in him? Who's trying to push him toward the continuation of the conflict? I don't believe it's all about Zelensky at all.
No, you're right. You're right, Nima. I think that, you know, if you paid attention to statements of, let's say, certain European leaders and military leaders, Western military leaders, then it's very clear that it's Western powers that are running the show in Ukraine, that Zelensky is simply there, a stand-in, you know, a sock puppet. And, you know, people like General Hodges, General Breedlove, Mark Milley and so forth, they have been, you know, pushing the military strategy of Ukrainian armed forces and you know, the governance of Ukrainian government. And then there's been heavy involvement by MI6 under Sir Richard Moore and so forth. And they have been talking about doing recruitment more aggressively, recruiting more women into the armed forces of Ukraine, recruiting younger people, recruiting older people. All of those pressures were coming from the West. And we know that, you know, we had these British think tanks who have been quite open in their reports about the, you know, the imperative need for the war in Ukraine to continue, so that, you know, it was, they didn't care how many Ukrainians died. They just needed the war to carry on, to go on and on and on and on. And they still need that because, you know, now the European leaders are talking about picking up the torch in 2028 or 29. But in order for that to happen, they need the war to go on. They need to prevent peace from happening, because then you have the problem of how do you start a brand new war? If one is already going on, then you can always finagle the crisis to, you know, throw in some troops. These, you know, Macron again is banging the drum about these reassurance troops, and he's scaring everybody with this this bloodthirsty ogre that's at our doors, meaning, you know, the Russians. And so if the mess is continuing, then you can just, you know, join that mess. If peace breaks out, then you have a problem. Well, how do we orchestrate a brand new war and get it started, which is, you know, not easy to do.
I don't know how, but somehow looking at the meeting, you don't see Stormer that much bold. You see Mertz. They somehow managed to put Mertz in a position. It seems to me that Mertz is somehow much more the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom than Stormer. How did they manage that? How could they achieve that, in your opinion, with Mertz?
Well, I think because they're all the same network of power. You know, they, you know, Mertz used to be a CEO of BlackRock for Germany. Emmanuel Macron used to be a Rothschild banker in France. Keir Starmer, not so much, but you know, Keir Starmer is a stand-in for Tony Blair in the same way as Joe Biden was a stand-in for Barack Obama. And Tony Blair is part of the City of London governance structure. You know, after he delivered them the Iraq War in 2003, they rewarded him with a $5 million a year consulting contract. Then they made him the envoy for peace for the Middle East, and on and on and on. And he is still deeply involved with all these events, with Ukraine, with the Middle East, with Syria, with Lebanon, with Israel. And Starmer is just one of his puppet protégés, who is probably doing whatever Tony Blair tells him to do. And then, you know, Tony Blair does whatever his employers tell him to do. And his employers are almost certainly the money-lending oligarchies that rule the City of London. And then whether, you know, whether we're talking about Mertz or Starmer or Macron, it's, you know, they all answer to the same ultimate structures of power, to the same powers that be that rule both London and Paris, and also, you know, have certain dominance in Germany, which could slip away from them, you know, if Mertz is overthrown in some way or voted out of office, then who knows, maybe AfD is going to take over. They're going to have to cancel German democracy in that case. And the same thing could happen with Emmanuel Macron, which is why they have cancelled, you know, his main challenger, Marine Le Pen. But, you know, that's a fight that they're constantly fighting. And then when they have their sock puppets in government, then they can do the division of labor. You know, Starmer is now under pressure because he's doing, not only is he pushing these wars, you know, backing Israel, backing Ukraine, he's also engaged in more and more heavy-handed suppression of dissent in Britain. And, you know, now in Britain, there's widespread perception that the country is likely to slip into a civil war, that there's going to be a massive revolt, a revolution on the streets of Britain. So then maybe, you know, the unpopular causes like the Ukraine war, maybe that torch goes to Mertz for the time being. And, you know, Macron is still kind of okay. He could help out, but, you know, maybe Starmer has to sit down and be quiet for a while.
Where is Poland in the whole calculation? Sikorski, remember, Poland, the most hawkish. We thought that they're going to be on the battlefield fighting Russians when this conflict started. You remember those days and how hawkish the Polish government was. Where are they right now? How do they feel about it?
Okay, so I'm not 100% certain, but the new government in Poland is it's a bit more difficult for me to read because they're still not very friendly to the Russians, but they're also not so friendly to the Ukrainians anymore because they're very sensitive to the, you know, World War II events in which, you know, the Ukrainian Nazi supporters slaughtered large numbers of Poles in, you know, the Katyn massacre and others. And so they're not happy with what about, I forget, is it 2 million Ukrainian refugees that are in Poland or 1.6 million? I forget the number, but there's a very, very large number of Ukrainian refugees that are in Poland that are in privileged positions. And, you know, the Polish people are resenting it. And then, you know, the European Union is, you know, to help Ukraine, they're giving Ukrainian agricultural production a privileged position in European markets, which is, you know, making life very, very difficult for Polish farmers, and not just Polish, but also, you know, your Romanian and Hungarians and so forth. And they resent that as well. So there's, you know, while there's no discernible dissent in terms of hostility towards Russia, there's definitely a dissent in terms of supporting Ukraine. And then some other things like, you know, policy on migrations and all these things. So I think that we will know more with time, but for the time being, it's a half story, you know. They're resenting the Project Ukraine, and they want to extricate themselves from it, but that they're not necessarily on you know, leaning towards very friendly terms with Russia. But then, you know, this is a very dangerous thing, because if you'll recall, I think it was 2009 or so, the Russians made the outreach to try to make improve Russian relations with Poland, and Vladimir Putin went to the site of the Katyn massacre from World War II, and he officially apologized to the people of Poland, and he acknowledged for the first time that the Soviets were partly responsible for this. And because up until then, you know, the massacre was kind of packaged as a Nazi atrocity. But the truth is that it was a Soviet atrocity. The Polish knew it, the Russians knew it, but the official narrative couldn't be questioned. And then Putin came to Poland and he acknowledged this, and he issued an official apology. And so I think the day after that, or 2 days after that, there was a whole plane load of Polish official, including the Polish president and a bunch of military generals, who flew for talks to Russia. And then somehow mysteriously that whole plane fell out of the sky and everybody on board was killed. And I don't know what the official status of that investigation is, but it seems to me that, you know, somebody in the world, some great power, doesn't want anybody in the West to have friendly relations with Russia. And anybody who goes to cultivate good relations with Russia, in the end, suffers consequences. And I think that Trump is maybe now the only person in the world who is in the Western world, who is strong enough politically that he can start improving relations with Russia. But it's not yet visible from Poland.
I think the main reason is somehow, to me, is that they cannot afford losing Russia as their worst enemy. They made something out of thin air, in my opinion, that doesn't exist anymore. There is no Soviet Union. There is no Communist Party in Russia. There is no moving toward Europe. But they still, they make something else. They say it's not communist, but it's a Tsar. It's the Russian imperialist ambitions that are coming toward us. This is, they're making something to go. That's why I'm not that much optimistic, Alex, when it comes to the relationship between the West and Russia, because they cannot afford it.
Well, I would say you're right, Nima, because this has a continuity stretching back to the 16th century, you know, when we had the Polish-Lithuanian invasion, and then we had the Swedish invasion on Russia and Napoleon, and it's just been wave after wave after wave of European powers attacking Russia. Some of it was outright military invasions, like, you know, Poland, Sweden, Napoleon, France, Hitler. Some of it was like subversion, color revolutions, infiltration. And so this has been going on nonstop. And always, you know, justified to domestic audiences in the West as Russia is bad, Russia is communist, Russians are ogres, troglodytes, they're backwards, they're Huns, they're Asiatic hordes, and so on. One thing has changed after 500 years of this. Well, you know, 450, let's call it. And that is the internet, because we never had this. And we never had the ability to see and hear Russian leaders in their own words. We never could have, you know, Tucker Carlson interviewing Vladimir Putin. We could never have Sergei Lavrov speak for a full hour or two to the Western audiences. We could never see the Russian people in, you know, in social media and find the truth in real time. So I think that's a factor that is unprecedented, but it definitely changes the social equation. And the way it changes it, we don't know, because we will only be finding out now. But it seems to me that today, this factor of frightening the populations in the West, that there's these barbarian hordes that will overrun us unless we arm to our teeth and go to war, I think that this no longer works. And I think that this is part of the problem, because they've been trying to scare us about Russia. But I know from a variety of sources that the opinions in the West, even in Western Europe, in places like France and Germany, the opinions are very, very divided. And I think that the majority of people does not believe that Russia is really a threat to us. So if you try to mobilize them, send them to war, have them destroy their countries and sacrifice hundreds of thousands of their children, it's not going to work like it did, you know, 70 years ago and 100 years ago, you know, World War II, World War I, and before that.
One of the main issues, Alex, in Ukraine is the security guarantees that the Russian part, the Western part is just talking about it, considering it. When it comes to the West, I'm talking about Europeans mostly, they think of Ukraine having some sort of deterrence and some sort of power to defend itself, which we know it would be the same policy that brought Ukraine to this sort of collapse and destruction. You know, they made Ukraine the way with since 2014 up until 2022. They made an army of 700 forces ready, prepared by NATO to fight. That gave Ukrainians some sort of delusional aspect that they can fight Russia, they can do something to Russia. I have never believed that on the part of the West, they thought that Ukraine would defeat Russia, but they wanted to trap Russia in Ukraine. That's why they, but on the part of Ukrainians, they were, I think they were somehow delusional that they can do something with that. And with this new policy of sending, giving Ukraine some sort of power to defend itself, it's the same policy. You want to militarize Ukraine. On the other hand, Russia wants to demilitarize Ukraine. This is the problem, I think, that they're facing in the negotiations.
Yes, well, you know, these are very, very relevant questions, but they're also full of nuance that, you know, makes it, you know, we have to be careful how we interpret it. I think that, you know, the West set up their own government in Ukraine, which was not democratic, in 2014, right? It was a military junta. And the whole point of it was to draw Russia into a trap, into a quagmire that would weaken Russia, that would enable the West to destabilize Russia and bring about a regime change. So from that point of view, they didn't need Ukraine to win anything, and they didn't care what happens to Ukraine or how many Ukrainians they sacrifice in the process. They just wanted to weaken and destabilize Russia. That was the purpose. And then, you know, if there were delusional people in Ukraine who thought that they could defeat Russia, I think their numbers were very, very small. And I think that what happened is that, you know, you put certain loyal people in positions of power and you give them incentives to push the whole society in that direction. And I learned this on your dialogue works, Nima. You had Colonel Jacques Beau who told us about the polls in Ukraine. I think they were run maybe 2 weeks before the war actually broke out. And they were asking people in Ukraine, well, if Russians attack, would you defend the country with weapons? Would you stand up and defend the country against the Russians? And the huge majority of Ukrainians said no. They were not interested in that war, even at that late stage, already in 2022, which tells you that this, you know, this at no point had anything to do with Ukrainian people. This had to do with certain structures of power that were set up by the, you know, Western powers, the United States and Britain and NATO countries, Poland and Germany included. And the objective of it was to subjugate Russia, to destroy it, to partition it, and to eliminate it as a political entity with any power on Eurasian landmass. Obviously, with the view of carrying forward, you know, then the next stop was China. But you know, to get to China, you needed to tame Russia first, and that was the whole role of Ukraine and the Ukrainian people. And, you know, the fact that they sacrificed 1.7 million Ukrainians, they don't care. They don't care at all. They never had it in mind to do anything good for Ukraine. And, you know, the preparations for this go back to 1991, from the time when Ukraine became an independent country, when the Soviet Union collapsed. Almost immediately, NATO went in there. And then they started having military exercises together in 1995. And then in Madrid, they signed the Treaty of Distinctive Partnership between NATO and Ukraine. And it just went on and on and on until the coup, when the cooperation and coordination and preparations went, you know, full on. And Ukrainians never asked for that, and nobody asked the Ukrainian people for it. And because the Ukrainians were opposed to this, they were, you know, majority of Ukrainians never wanted to enter NATO to begin with. This is why in 2014 it was necessary to stage a coup and replace the democratically elected government with a military junta. And then, you know, the rest has been what we saw, preparations for war, a provocation to Russia, and then fighting Russia and making sure that fighting continued, because there's been several attempts, both on Russian and Ukrainian side, to come to some kind of a peace deal to stop the war. And the Western powers always intervened to prevent the peace from breaking out, to make sure that the war continues. And this is where we're at. And, you know, unfortunately, I have to say that if people don't learn from this, then the same could happen to Romania, to Poland, to Moldova, to all of them.
Azerbaijan.
Exactly, Armenia. exactly, to all of them. And, you know, we need to understand where this is coming from and why. Obviously, it has nothing to do with freedom and democracy. It has nothing to do with human rights. It has nothing to do with joining NATO or joining the EU. It all has to do with money lending oligarchies extending their colonial control over the whole world. And, you know, Russia, Iran, China are in the way of that, and they have to be destroyed.
Here is, since you've mentioned the deep roots of the conflict in Ukraine, here is what Soros said on, it's an old video, but it's somehow revealing what they were doing in Ukraine.
Pleasure to have you on.
Same here.
First on Ukraine, one of the things that many people recognized about you was that you, during the revolutions of 1989, funded a lot of dissident activity, civil society groups in Eastern Europe, in Poland, the Czech Republic. Are you doing similar things in Ukraine?
Well, I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
Do you think Ukraine will be able to assert a kind of independence from Russia and an alignment with the West? Not a specific alignment as in NATO, but a kind of orientation toward the West, or will the Russians always stop them?
No, Putin will try to destabilize Ukraine. The foundation has been functioning ever since, and it played an important part in events now.
Isn't that amazing that he's telling us something that Antony Blinken, before the war started in Ukraine, was telling us? Russia is destabilizing Ukraine. And the same quotes, you hear the same quotes coming from, it's, yeah.
Yes, I think a much better testimonial by George Soros, incidentally, is a document that he published. He wrote it, and it was published on the pages of the Open his own Open Society Institute in 1993, and the title of the document was "Toward a New World Order," in which he pretty much says that, you know, they would have to use NATO to impose the new world order on you know, pretty much the rest of the planet. And then he discusses the problem of European countries not being inclined towards war, that it would be politically very, very difficult to send European troops into war against Russia. And then he said, so, you know, we should use Eastern European troops as, you know, so we supply them weapons and ammunition and training, and they do the fighting and dying. And that's, I mean, what he wrote in that document, again, you know, I think it's still on Open Society's webpages, and it's called Towards a New World Order. Hold on, let me check. Toward a New World Order, the Future of NATO, published in November 1993, right? So that is a much more revealing document, because it spells out exactly what we've seen happen. And the document was published 32 years ago. So the fact that world events have unfolded according to a scenario that one man wrote and published 32 years ago, you know, if you are investigating a crime, that would be like a crown piece of evidence. And then you would have to ask yourself, who is this person? Who is George Soros? How does he know all this? How did he know all this? Who does he work for? Where does he get the money to do what he's doing? And then you start getting to very interesting conclusions. And, you know, then you realize that this 500 years of continuity of, you know, European colonial powers shaping the development of world events is what we're living today. And so all the talk about, you know, human rights and democracy and freedom and this and that, it's all on the facade. It's just for public consumptions to engineer consent for war. But in fact, the ultimate interests that are driving this march to war, it's always the same ones that compelled Sweden to invade Russia, that compelled Napoleon to invade Russia, that compelled Hitler to invade Russia. And, you know, we have to understand that in 1941, in July, when Hitler invaded Russia, it wasn't Hitler. It was most of the European countries that joined that invasion. It was the largest invasion force ever assembled. I think it was something like 3 million troops. That was, you know, Finland and Sweden and Holland and Hungary and Czech Republic and Slovakia, Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, Moldova, Ukraine, Croatia, Italy, Spain, France. That was a European project. It was very similar to what we're seeing today. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, beyond the facade, beyond the supposed democratic structures of governance that we think we have in Europe, we have to ask ourselves who are and what are the interests that are driving us constantly into war and why. And once we understand that, then we can, I think, finally stop this cycle. And I think that thankfully, people like Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping have figured it out. I think that the leadership in Iran has figured it out. And I think that also the people around Trump have figured it out as well. And I think that they're saying no mas.
I think the last countries to be joined to understand what's going on are Brazil and India. They're somehow getting there. They somehow understanding what's going on with the West. And I don't know how deep India is there, but they're somehow, the things that are happening between India and China are considerable, in my opinion.
Yes, but you know, the problem is that the political class in all of these countries is always divided. You know, there will be some people who are sovereigntist and nationalist and who want to chart an independent course. And there are other people who, you know, like to send their children to Oxford and Cambridge and MIT and Harvard, and who like to have their apartments and chalets in Swiss ski resorts and yachts on the Mediterranean in the south of France and so forth. And then they have, you know, they will want to remain loyal to Western centers of power. At a given, well, you could say the same for Germany as well, and for Poland, and for Hungary, and for any nation. But I think that at a certain point in time, then one of these factions is going to become dominant. And I think that the world events, as we've witnessed them, I would say, since 2019, I think they're giving more and more credibility towards to nationalists and sovereigntists in most countries, and less credibility to the globalists who are still loyal to the City of London and to Wall Street and other financial centers of the world. And so that's, I think that that's a tide that's very slowly turning, but I think it's turning with such, it's so broad-based and so powerful that I don't see how it can be reversed. I think that every day that passes, more people switch sides against the global empire and for, well, whatever we could call it, multipolar integrations. And I don't think there's any kind of a narrative that would reverse that course. And if you, you know, if you analyze what the Western world, what the globalists are offering, it's really just pathetic. It's idiotic. It's LGBT ideology. It's net zero, Great Reset, and migrations. Nothing good. Nothing that people want. And I mean, capturing carbon from the atmosphere to bury it underground. I don't know anybody who asked for that. I don't know anybody who thinks that's a good idea, but they're doing it anyway. And so I think that whole facade, that whole edifice is going to crumble.
Alex, how do you see the Middle East, and do you think are we seeing some sort of calmness before a storm coming up in the Middle East? What's going on there? Israel is trying to capture all of Gaza. On the other hand, you see this situation in Syria is somehow in some sort of turmoil. It doesn't get away with the region. We see the conflict between Iran and Israel. What can we expect from the Middle East, in your opinion?
In one word, escalation, I think. And it's on too many fronts now. It's, you know, you have Israel trying to capture all of Gaza, which is not going so well. It seems to me that the Israeli troops are taking a lot of casualties, and that they're concealing their casualty. I think that they lose a lot more people than they admit. And as a result, the IDF is exhausted, depleted, demoralized. And if what I hear from reports is correct, the defections are reaching 50%. You know, 50% of people are simply not turning up when drafted. And Israel is spreading itself thin because, you know, Hezbollah never vanished. Hezbollah is still there. I think that in Egypt, Sisi is going to have a hard time holding off against Israel. Israel is also embroiled in a very complicated situation in Syria, where, you know, the Israelis know what they want there. The problem is that the Turks, who control HDS, want the same thing. And it seems that Turkey and Israel are on the collision course irreversibly. And now this crisis is already spreading to Cyprus, where, you know, we've seen all these Israelis disembark in Cyprus, and, you know, on the Greek side, they're thinking, like, what's going on? But the Turks are clearly very alarmed. And they have planned to beef up the military presence of Turkish army on Cyprus from about 40,000 troops now to more than 100,000 troops. And they're citing Israeli threat as a reason for it. And then there are increasing calls within Turkey to take all of Cyprus, to simply evict the Greeks from Cyprus, and to simply take the island to be part of the Turkish nation. And then we have two large British military bases in Turkey, and, you know, wherever the British are present, you know, it's only a matter of time before trouble brews up. And then it appears that the Netanyahu government, they want to renew their hostilities with Iran. And on the Iranian side, there's almost unanimous conviction that the attack is coming, that it's only a matter of time, and probably it could happen this month, which means what, we have 10 days left in this month. So within the next 10 days, we might see an attack on Iran from Israel. And the Iranians believe that the United States will not be able to stay out of that conflict. So there are now growing voices inside of Iran at very high influential levels that they should actually launch an attack on Israel rather than passively wait for Israel to attack, to simply, if you can't avoid the fight, then maybe it's better to land the first punch. And so the Iranians apparently have prepared for this, and it's a matter of making a decision. My understanding is that Iran has enough drones and missiles to practically create a conveyor belt towards Israel that could continuously deliver drones and missiles for 2 years. And we've already seen what happened after 12 days.
Yeah.
What if they, and you know, the talk is that if Iran does launch a preemptive attack on Israel this time around, it won't be a small thing. It would be final. They will go for a kill to destroy, to literally this time wipe Israel off the map. And so if that happens, then I think longer term, the situation in the Middle East might get diffused, because Israel has been exactly the instigator of all the instability and war and quarrels in the region. But I think that in the meantime, things are likely to escalate. And even if Iran doesn't launch a preemptive attack, if Israel does attack Iran, Iran's response is going to be very, very devastating.
Yeah. I think your assessment is quite on point when it comes to Iran and the mindset of Iranians. That would be, in my opinion, a suicide. But it's a suicide for Israel, but for Netanyahu, it somehow is concerned.
Nima, it never stopped them now until now. You know, they don't care. They go to war against everybody. They're, what, on seven fronts? And they were even, the Israelis are even saying, well, once we're done with Iran, Pakistan is next.
Pakistan,
Turkey, Pakistan, it doesn't matter. Egypt, we're going to kill everybody. We're going to flatten everybody, and we're going to call it peace. You know, it's unbelievable. But you know, the conduct of Israeli foreign policy has not been rational. It's been very, very irrational. It's been pretty insane. And so I think it wouldn't be strange if it continued to be insane, which means that a suicidal attack on Iran would be perfectly in their job description.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with
us
today.
Always a pleasure, Nima. Thank you.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.